Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Investigators in South Africa say that they are pursuing the suspects behind the killing of Mohsin Hendricks, who was regarded as the world's first openly gay imam. How is he being mourned by those who knew him?
When I asked him how he coped with the threats on his life, he mentioned to me that he barely stays in one house for more than 1 year. With this discussion that I have with Imam Mohsin, I would not be surprised that the assassination was on the basis of hate crime, but not just hate crime only, but also on the basis of his religious stance.
And we take an overview of the prison system in Africa.
So the prison systems generally are all overcrowded. If you walk into any prison in Africa at the moment, you'll find that they're all characterized by old dilapidated buildings, very little ventilation, and the prisoners in some of the prisons, you'd find that clinics are not available.
What can be done to reform it? It's Tuesday, February 18th. First, we go to Mali. Have a listen to this. It's a woman with a child on her back looking for gold at an informal mine in Mali. And it's a very common sight. Mali is one of the biggest gold producers in the world, yet its citizens are some of the poorest, with more than a fifth of its population living in extreme poverty, according to the World Bank. This drives many people to go looking for scraps of gold in unregulated and unsafe gold mines left behind by industrial miners. Accidents are common. Close to 50 people died in the latest one on Saturday when a mine collapsed in Mali's Western Kayes region. Most of the victims were women, some with children on their backs. It is believed the incident took place at an abandoned site formerly operated by a Chinese company. This woman and man are both miners in Mali and told us why they go to the mines.
It is because we won't have money to feed our children. We are poor. We are aware of the risk that involves in this work. But we will continue doing it until we have another means of survival. We want to get out of poverty. That is why we are doing this risky work.
Poverty is what is driving us to this dangerous job. If you are living in Bamako, you don't have money to do business. You have no alternative but to risk your life in doing illicit mining. Many people die every year while doing artisanal mining. Some people die without being noticed until their bodies decompose. We are praying to God to save us from this dangerous job.
I asked Beverly Ochieng, an expert on Mali at Control Risks in Dakar, what was known about this mine.
So this incident took place in the western region of Mali, the Kayes region, which is one of the biggest industrial mining sectors. But there are also various other mines that have previously been used by industrial stakeholders that are now being mined informally by local communities. So this was in the Keneba district. A mine collapsed where there had been some illegal gold mining site taking place. The majority of victims out of the 50 people who, nearly 50 people were killed were women. One is even said to be having a child on her back. It's an area that is well known for both the commercial gold sector that runs the Malian economy, but also for informal communities that will be carrying out mining activities either on abandoned mines or areas that haven't been formally cleaned by the government or other industrial stakeholders.
And what is meant, Beverly, by artisanal mining? What does that mean?
So artisanal mining tends to be a term whereby someone would be working independently, or a community of people would be working independently to be able to obtain a mineral in an area. In most instances, it would be a company or industrial company that would establish, you know, a factory which would be doing the production, the digging out. But in these instances, it's just big chunks of land whereby people will be looking for gold using very rudimentary material and panning it. These are areas that tend to be sometimes controlled by local communities. In more volatile parts of the Sahel, in Mali and Burkina Faso, armed groups tend to run these areas. So foreigners would be coming in mass. They'd be prospecting for gold in areas that are known to have that mineral resource. They would be panned out using water, and which is why you find that there's often flooding that takes place, or instances where mines collapse because they're not using proper equipment. They never have, for instance, things to protect their heads or to protect their bodies. They go there with whatever they're wearing. They will dig it up. Sometimes there's environmental degradation as a result of their activities, but by and large, it doesn't involve very sophisticated equipment. In terms of even protective gear, there tends to be none. It's very localized, and sometimes it runs a very small area within a 50 to 100 kilometer radius economy where people are mining and selling that to people who are able to buy, or to smaller stakeholders, opposed to when a big company establishes a mine and it's being run by the government as well as that company.
And these activities are happening in abandoned sites. Must be really horrible, the conditions in there. Could you describe for us?
I mean, for the most part, people would not be receiving any form of protective gear. They could just be wearing the normal clothes that you would leave the household with. There is a lot of dust. Sometimes they use explosives, which are not being regulated properly. Sometimes there are instances of poisoning, whether it's the water in the area, because there are also areas that are very close to rivers and other environmental resources. There's no protective gear for people who are working there, so they would be caught up in the heat and the dust, and they're exposed to chemicals. They do not have anything, for instance, like ladders or sort of lifts that would allow them to go into very deep pits, sometimes hundreds of meters long. So when accidents like these happen, you find that it's not just about not having the protective gear, it's about the whole environment not being in, it's in a fragile state. The more you dig, the more you compromise that environment. So when accidents like these happen, it's very difficult to carry out rescue operations in good time. There's also no formal state presence. So for there to be coordinated rescue efforts where you get either local authorities or the police or emergency services to be able to come and support people tends to be very difficult. Labor issues also emerge. Sometimes children are involved in mining activities against child labor laws. You find that younger and younger people would be pulled out of school because either they're not operational and they're engaging in these activities. They don't make as much money, but it is quick turnaround cash that enables you to live day to day as opposed to long-term sustenance and protection.
And in this latest incident, Beverly, most of the victims happened to be women. Tell us how that happened and why.
I mean, women tend to be the unspoken class of people who would be working in artisanal mines. In this part of Mali, due to increasing insecurity, which has been over the last 2 years, and the fact that there is very little in terms of formal economy, a lot of women are finding themselves, due to lack of opportunities, gravitating towards these artisanal mines. And this is just one snapshot of just how many women are now engaged in this local economy. So you will find that a lot of women who do not have either land, because land and property rights are also quite contentious, who may not have formal education, who are not able to sustain longer term or other economic activities, will be taking part in a labor sector that has often been saturated with men. And some of them even have children, as one of the victims who passed on was said to have had one.
One wonders, do men allow them to go into these mines?
I mean, yes, it does mean that you are still bringing profit to the family. It's probably being run by the household. But for the most part, also, men might be engaged in the more formal economy. Some might be engaged in militant activity. Some might be overseeing the mines themselves. And it becomes more of a collective effort. More women are bringing, you know, means and food to the table. And if it means being engaged in the mining industry, then that is one sector that they would be allowed to. Mali is not very conservative about where women or men would be, you know, likely to work, except for in areas where they're under militant control. But women are as much involved in the mining sector, as we've seen from this snapshot, as men are. It's just that they're not as much highlighted due to historic issues around representation, land rights, and even the fact that there are fewer and fewer formal and informal opportunities for women to be involved in, especially in a region that is becoming increasingly volatile.
Beverly, we understand this was a collapsed mine. What more do we know about that?
Well, so it's an area which mining had initially been banned by the authorities. Sometime in 2024, they issued a directive saying because of the weather, there had been extreme weather across Mali and flooding had taken place. Artisanal mining activities were suspended indefinitely, but it still continued at a very low scale. And because floodwaters were still accumulated in the region, it's why this accident was likely to happen. It's not the first time it has happened. Last year in the same region, about 70 people were killed after a mine collapsed, and that's part of the reason why the government imposed the ban. But it's very difficult to regulate the mining sector because for the most part, the government engages with it as a security risk or an economic risk rather than an operational risk in which they could potentially provide local stakeholders with a better means of exploiting those resources and even being part of the formalized economy. One of the things that we have looked at, for instance, a control risk, is how both industrial companies as well as governments can still support the informal mining economy so that it's able to be better empowered in terms of protection and being able to also generate income through the formal economy. But with Mali, for the most part, it tends to be either total bans or indefinite bans. People still continue to carry out mining. More and more accidents are reported. And in many instances, those who may be responsible for running those areas are never quite held accountably. It's also very difficult to register formally mines, which is why most people tend to go the artisanal route. By the time you get a government license or a permit to be able to operate an area or a scope, there's issues around institutional corruption. Most people are more willing to just start an operation in an area that is known to have gold or any other mineral before going to the local authorities to be able to formally register and carry out the operation in a way that would be much more manageable and less risky.
Beverly Ochieng, an expert on Mali and the Sahel at Control Risks in Dakar. This is Mohsin Hendricks, recorded while leading prayers at a mosque in Cape Town, South Africa. He was a 57-year-old cleric and the world's first openly gay imam. To many, he was a symbol of peace and resilience, but his life was tragically cut short last Saturday morning. The car he was traveling in near the southern city of Gbeya was ambushed, leaving the LGBTQ plus community and beyond in shock. Tributes have poured in, with many mourning his loss and honoring his legacy. I spoke with Ishmael Bahati. He is the executive director of PEMA Kenya, a gender and sexual minority-led organization. Ishmael knew Imam Hendricks in person and began by sharing who Mohsin was to him.
I would describe Imam Mohsin as a very patient, loving someone that you can look up to as a role model, especially when you are working around reconciling Islam and sexuality.
Ishmael, if you could explain to us then his work and the impact that it has had over the years.
I met Imam Mohsin in 2010 at the height of attacks on LGBT community along the Kenyan coast in 2010, February. And I was linked up with him because at that time the attacks were done by Muslims, both religious leaders and followers. And as a result, I was connected to Imam Mohsin by one of our partners just to understand my sexuality and my Islam could be reconciled. And Imam Mohsin was very instrumental because I was naive. I still did not recognize the fact that I could be both a Muslim and still be comfortable in my queer life. So the journey with Imam Mohsin begins when I met him, and he really understood where I was coming from, addressed my fears, and then later on he invited me to a training in 2014. And in 2014, the training was the first ever to be done by Imam Mohsin under the Inner Circle. And the training was basically to have international trainers all over the world. We were 10 of us from different countries to basically go through understanding that we can be both Islam, Muslims, and queer persons in our identities and be comfortable. I can say it is in this space that I ever saw a transgender person leading prayers without being judged. I have also been able to work with him on a project in Tanzania, but specifically in Kenya, we have done a great job in terms of training individuals that are willing to carry on training others or giving other information to be able to be comfortable in their two identities.
How would you describe then the kind of impact that his teachings had on you specifically, if you could elaborate for us or had on people that you've met and worked with?
If there's anything that I ever learned from Imam Hussein was the courage in spite of dangerous moments. And I think people are very comfortable when queer persons identify themselves just as a queer person, a gay person, a lesbian, differently. But the moment you come to terms with your two identities and you declare that you are a queer person who is a Muslim, then that becomes a problem. And one of the things that he did was to journey us through basically understanding your own position, your own power, and the ability to speak out and have a discussion and dialogues. For example, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah in the Quran, the interpretation of it, and what were the sins of the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, the common arguments that people bring up when it comes to Islam and gender and sexual minority identities. And also another thing that he did very well was also defining a process of coming out in 10 steps, basically building your resilience to be able to know when is the right time to speak out about your sexuality and when it's not the right time, and how to scan the environment and to ensure that you are not endangered as you speak or do your advocacy and dialogues.
To South Africa now, where tributes continue to come in for Mohsin Hendrik. He was shot dead in broad daylight.
What's been your reaction then after this horrible news that Imam Mohsin had been shot dead in South Africa?
Oh dear, you have no idea how it was for me, because one, I was with the Imam at the end of November. I left him on 2nd or 3rd December, and I had been in South Africa for 3 weeks, and the last 1 week I spent with him. And this year, I think towards the end of January, we spoke about the possibility of him coming to Kenya again, because we have a new cohort of faith leaders who can take them through understanding Islam and homosexuality in general. So we had a real conversation about that. So just imagining that he was shot dead, it was really devastating. First, I couldn't believe. I had stomach pain, you know, all those things that comes with the reaction of, you know, disbelief. So I even tried to text his number. I even tried to call people that are close to him to confirm that indeed he was dead, and it was devastating. When I woke up, I was only hoping that someone can tell me that, you know, there was a mistake somewhere and Imam is well. But unfortunately, this is only remains as wishes. Imam Hussein is dead.
Sorry for that, Ishmael. Some fear, and I'm just saying fear because we do not know the cause or the reason as to why he was killed, but some fear that this could have been a hate crime. What's your take on that?
As a person who has also been threatened for speaking about Islam and sexuality as an okay thing, when I was first attacked, Imam Mohsin was the first person I reached out to so that he could understand the context, because I was getting threats from Muslim religious leaders in Coast in Mombasa. And he told me that he actually has had many, many such a kind of attacks. I have also lived in his house, so I also know the kind of threat that he has been receiving. He even informed me when I asked him how he coped with the threats on his life. He mentioned to me that he barely stays in one house for more than 1 year. With this discussion that I have with Imam Hussein, I would not be surprised that the assassination was on the basis of hate crime, but not just hate crime only, but also on the basis of his religious stance, especially when it came to being open about his sexuality and being radical in terms of ensuring that people do not feel deceived or people have the right information, contrary to what other scholars had. Different opinions, let me just say.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think his legacy is going to be?
I would think that Imam Hussein was an exemplary role model, a mentor, and a teacher to many of us, something that will forever remain in our hearts. I have known Imam Hussein since 2010, And you can imagine that I've never seen Imam Hussein angry at someone. Imam Hussein had this way of staying calm, responding to the person calmly with love, and showing the person that there's a better way you could have done this. So Imam Hussein remains one of a person that has really, really touched our life, changed our way of thinking. And one of the things that I would remember, because this was a turning point for me and Imam Hussein, was that he took me a verse that reads that at the end, the oppressed persons, in this case referring to queer persons, will come to the presence of Allah and they will ask him, how was the world? And this, they will say that the world was oppressive for us. And then the angel of Allah will ask them, that was the earth of Allah not too big enough for you to find a place to pray? He told me that there is no excuse for a queer person to say that I was not allowed to pray because the world was discriminating to me or oppressive to me, but rather you find your own Islam in your own way and find space to worship Allah in your own space. His legacy is that of compassion, peace, and being patient.
And then, Ishmael, how do you think faith leaders and interfaith organizations can work together to continue this legacy of inclusivity that Imam Hussein championed for?
Most of the faith spaces that we see that are accommodative to queer persons are mostly Christian and other religions, but we think that most spaces for queer persons, especially those who have been able to journey with Imam and they have not had spaces that they could be themselves, they could come together to support the larger work of the movement. I think this would be the biggest thing that we can do for Imam Hussein.
Ishmael Bahati, the executive director of PEMA Kenya. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. This is a song sung by women at a prison in Africa. They are thanking visitors who had come to check on them, a right that those imprisoned don't always get. Thing is, the prison system in Africa is in need of reforms. Problems such as overcrowding and violence are rife in most prisons. In fact, the occupancy rate of prisons in most countries is over 170%. In a recent visit to Senegal, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Alice Jill Edwards, warned that the country must take action to tackle overcrowding in its prisons, which she described as inhumane. She said it was a flashpoint that could spark riots at any moment, as well as violence and the spread of infectious diseases. 2 years ago, a Nigerian senator, Ben Mari Bruce, also called for reforms in prisons.
It is time for Nigeria to introduce comprehensive prison reforms that go beyond just punitive measures. These reforms must also focus on the rehabilitation and productivity of inmates. To address this, both the government and prison authorities must embark on a transformative journey towards creating self-sufficient prisons that encourage education, vocational training, and sustainable industries.
To find out what's happening across prison systems in Africa, I turned to Doreen Namyalo Chaze from Penal Reform International, which is based in Uganda. And I began by asking her what conditions are like in prisons on the continent.
So the prison systems generally are all overcrowded. If you walk into any prison in Africa at the moment, you'll find that they're all characterized by old dilapidated buildings, very little ventilation, and you'd find that there are issues concerning water access. And the prisoners in some of the prisons, you'd find that clinics are not available because of the huge congestion. It's not possible to find a separate room, for example, for the ill prisoners. So many of them have to designate a cell, which is meant for prisoners generally to be used as a sick bay.
All right, Doreen, talk to us about whether fundamental human rights are an issue as well. You've alluded to overcrowding, and in what ways does that affect the basic human rights that prisoners should be accessing?
Prison administrations generally come at the bottom of budgeting by governments in Africa. And because of that, there's inadequate human resource, but also resources needed for them to support the growing population or the huge population inside of prisons. There are food shortages, which means that many of the prisoners are not able to have the 3 meals a day. There is very poor health care inside the prisons. In most of the countries, the prison health care is of far inferior quality compared to that in the community. I give an example of there's an increasing number of mentally ill people that are entering prison services, cutting across sub-Saharan Africa. The access to healthcare support is almost negligible and many prisons absent.
I'm just wondering, sometimes we do hear that there are countries that have very good prison systems. Given what you've described for us as what is available in most African countries, can we talk about how a good prison system should look like from a provision of services point of view, as well as access to basic needs?
I think a good prison system, if we look at some countries like the Scandinavian countries that have done very well, and actually a good prison system is one that should work towards rehabilitation and reform. And that is why in many countries now prisons are being closed. Unfortunately, in Africa, both attitude and resources are constraining our realization of that. The bias towards people who enter the criminal justice system also limits the kind of support that is needed to foster rehabilitation and reform. But the problem that we are faced with in Africa, it starts at the point of arrest. The entire justice system pretty much needs reform. We also have very archaic laws that were passed in colonial times. Right. So it should foster reform and reintegration. That's a good prison system.
Right. I'm wondering, Doreen, if there are any projects being carried out on the continent to reform the system from what it is today?
Yes, there are definitely many programs that are currently being implemented in several countries. For example, in most of the prisons now, they've installed cameras and scanners and all those things. Increasingly, in most of the countries, they have introduced education programs for the prisoners from primary level in Commonwealth countries to as high as university programs. So, which is good, has restored hope for most of the prisoners. Where these programs exist, you find that prisoners are now more willing to participate in that, but we are seeing them becoming responsible citizens following their incarceration.
Yes. I'm just wondering if all these reforms are happening at the same pace across, you know, most of the countries on the continent, or could you give us an example of maybe countries that are doing a better job in reforming their prison system and the ones that are not doing such a good job at it?
What I was saying is because we do have the African Correction Service Association, which provides a platform for many of these correction systems to come together every 2 years. We have one this year and take stock on what was agreed to support the reforms in the different institutions to improve institutions. And so some of these things have really spread across most of the countries, although some remain behind, especially in conflict countries like South Sudan. The prison system is broken. Central African Republic, the prison system is broken. In Sudan right now, there's been an attack on most of the prisons. So the prison there was prison break, I think, that was already reported. So most of the conflict countries are challenged. But other countries, including Uganda, Kenya, Senegal, Malawi, Zimbabwe, there are reforms taking place. And the developments may be slow. For example, Tanzania is not yet very open, but Uganda is open, Kenya is open. There is a very good rehabilitation and reintegration program in Rwanda. Progress is being made.
There's still concerns, though, that these reforms are not happening fast enough. Why is that the case, and what do we need to do to accelerate the process?
The reforms to happen, it needs to have a holistic approach. The prisons are being reformed on that end, but there is a glaring gap between the collaboration of the prison system and the other chains of the justice system, the police and the judiciary, there is a disconnect. So for there to be significant reforms, it is important for the other arms of the government to realize the importance of the prison system itself and not to look at it as a penitentiary or a place where the undeserving go. For example, I'll give a case in point. In Uganda at the moment, the prison law has been in parliament more than 10 years ago for revision. Nobody looks at it because it's not a priority on the political agenda. So this law has not yet passed. Several laws like the Penal Code Act, which is really the one that describes the offences and the penalties, has also been up for reform, but the reforms have never been registered, not only in Uganda, but also Kenya. So the slow progress on the revision of the penal laws is also impacting on the correction systems. So that needs to work. The judiciary also has not reformed its approaches on hearing criminal cases. In many of the southern African countries, criminal cases are only heard according to sessions. Sessions are determined at the will of the judiciary. So if we cannot have the criminal cases heard every day, meaning that the prisoners are denied their rights to be heard speedily, so which means countries will continue to have huge remand populations. So this is why we have a huge prison congestion, because some of the factors that are contributing is delayed court hearings. And the delayed court hearings is because of the system that determined that hears only criminal cases periodically. It could be twice a year. It could be once a year. It could be none in a given year. So for the reforms to happen at the prison, there's also need for reforms across the entire justice system.
Doreen Namyalo Chaze from Penal Reform International in Uganda. Focus on Africa was put together by Sunita Naha and Stefanio Kereke in London. Paul Bachibinga was a senior producer. Gabriel O'Regan was a technical producer. Our editors are Andrea Lombard and Alice Mudengi. In our sister podcast, Africa Daily, Alan Kasuja has been speaking to veteran South Sudanese writer Taban Lo Leong and finds out why the scribe at 93 is not ready to stop working. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll speak again soon.